Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of July. I don't know how many of you saw the New York Times magazine section on Sunday, but there's a fascinating article about Animal Farm, and it's spelled P-H-A-R-M. We'll be talking about the medications that we've been giving our dogs and cats to treat mood disorders and also obsessions. One veterinarian says that all of the behavior issues that we created in ourselves, we're now creating in our pets because they live in the same unhealthy environments that we do. That's why there's a market for these drugs. But the article asks this really basic question, which I think is fascinating. Why do animals develop mental illnesses that resemble human ones and that also respond to the same medications? And what is it can we learn about animal minds that might be similar to human minds? Surveys by the American Pet Products Manufacturers Association found that 77% of dog owners, 52% of cat owners gave their animals some sort of medication in 2006, and that's up at least 25 percentage points from 2004. We talk this hour of our program with Dr. Karen Overall, Research Associate in the Department of Psychiatry and the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Clinical Behavioral Medicine for the Small Animal and the Manual of Veterinary Behavioral Medicine. I expect we'll get a lot of phone calls on this issue because many of us have pets and we love them and we think that some of them may not be very well. So we welcome your phone calls as we always do. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, do that at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Dr. Karen Overall, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for asking me.
I thought it was a fascinating article. You must have as well.
It's an interesting article, and I don't agree with a lot of it, but the subject is interesting, and it's important because not only do we love our animals, as that article points out, but these have now become, especially for people like me, issues about how we can become more humane and how we can better meet our pets and other animals' needs.
Mm-hmm. Let's ask what I think is one of the more important questions in the article. Why do animals develop mental illnesses that, as they say, eerily resemble human ones and that respond to the same medications?
Well, this is actually not shocking. My PhD is actually in zoology and evolutionary biology, and the parts of the brain that are involved in fear and anxiety and obsessive-compulsive types of behaviors are actually the oldest centers of your brain. They're conserved and present in all mammals. So it's not shocking that you have the ability to have those responses. What's interesting is that dogs likely co-evolved with humans. We now know that the molecular changes that have occurred in dogs' brains as a result of association with humans occur at a different rate and are different than those that are present in wolf brains. So it's not just the process of domestication. It's that in the situation with dogs, there have been dogs around as long as there have been modern humans. And for at least a quarter of the time that there have been modern humans, dogs have had this close, collaborative working relationship. So their frontal cortex actually works very much like ours. And that's the front part of the brain that's involved in what we call executive function, how you make decisions, how you problem solve. And it shouldn't surprise us then that they could suffer the same pathologies that we do, because actually, not only are they often in the same environments, but they have the same evolutionary history for brain development.
Oh, that's fascinating. Just fascinating.
Yeah, and people don't understand
that.
And it's interesting because I just came back from, and I'm quieting my own dog.
Hi, honey.
There are four of them. If you only hear one, it'll be a good day.
You have, what do you have, Australian Shepherds?
I do, and they're all rescues. We only take rescues because this is a breed that people will euthanize or relinquish fairly quickly because they're very smart and they're very active, and they will get themselves into trouble if you expect to understimulate them. You know, they're recently, all of these dogs are actually off stock line. So you know, they want to work. They want to do stuff. And mm-hmm. one is a service dog, and the other does some visitation. And, you know, they do lots of things. So they're interesting dogs. But I just got back from the first Canine Science Forum, which was a meeting of scientists who work on dogs. And shockingly enough, this was in Budapest, and there were 230 people attending this, which is remarkable for a first meeting of this kind. And they ranged from people interested in the human-animal bond to molecular biologists to those of us who, you know, take clinical things and look to genetically map them. One of my colleagues was actually mentioned in that article. Steve Hamilton is my collaborator, and we've been spending most of the past year and a half trying to map genes involved in noise reactivity. And what was interesting about this meeting is that the emphasis was on canine cognition and how much dogs are similar to humans in the way they think and how different dogs are from wolves in many ways, even though they've retained many wolf-like characteristics. So, you know, there was a group of 230 scientists who suddenly seemed to have all gotten the fact that, hey, this is an evolved or a co-evolved system. And it shouldn't surprise us that the further we look, the more dogs are like us.
Hmm. And we didn't used to think that way?
No. God, no. And we still don't. The average human still doesn't. You know, they look at their cat or they look at their dog, and they don't realize that cats and dogs have a completely different evolutionary story. You know, the story of cats and humans is the story of disease control. We tolerated cats because they controlled rodents, and rodents carried plague and other diseases.
Right.
We've had very little influence over the behavior of cats until the past 50 years. You know, used to think of cats as very aloof, and they're not. They just have a different signaling and social system than dogs because they weren't truly domesticated. And now you look at ads for cats, and they say personality plus good talker. and, you know, we've selected for that. We've asked for cats to change. But people think of their cats and dogs as not autonomous individuals, not cognitive individuals, not animals with needs. They think of them as something that they've added to their household, but they don't fully appreciate that it's like adding a human.
Right. Do they think?
Do dogs and cats think? Of course they think. They think. They solve problems. They reason. I'll go out on a limb here because I've said it publicly. I fully believe that dogs have a version of language, and the more people are studying their vocalizations, the more that's beginning to become apparent, is that they signal very discrete things vocally. There's less work done on cats, mostly because, you know, we think we have dogs, but cats have us.
Right.
So people don't work on them to the same extent. But it's a shame because there's a lot there. And they think and they problem solve. And there's even evidence that indicates that dogs undergo something called fast mapping, which is when you generalize to groups of things and identify things by groups. And that's actually involved in the first stage of language acquisition in humans.
Isn't that remarkable? You mentioned in the article in the Times centers on disorders in dogs. You mentioned fear and anxiety.
Yes.
Are those the most common problems that dogs have, or are there others?
It depends on who's doing the classification, and this is a problem in the field. And it was actually a problem in that article because that article didn't clearly separate out normal responses versus truly pathological responses that are due to the animal, not the environment. You can have a pathology involving fear or anxiety that's due to your genetics, and then you're put in an environment where those genetics are displayed, and then you have a problem. Or you can develop a problem because somebody abused you.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing's true with humans. And there are some humans that are much more resistant to abuse and some humans that are very sensitive to it. And it's the same with these animals. So when you look at how we make a diagnosis, I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of truly pathological behaviors in cats and dogs are rooted in underlying anxiety. And some of those are associated with fear. And part of the problem is fear and anxiety are different neurochemically, but they're related. So it's a struggle about what we're going to call it.
Right. And so what are your thoughts about medicating animals for fear, for anxiety, for mood disorders?
Well, you know, and I don't use the term mood disorders because it's this blurry type of distinction that I don't that I don't find helpful. I don't doubt that dogs have moods. You know, you can see when they're crabby. You can see when they don't feel well. You can see when they're enthusiastic. The same thing with cats. I'd prefer to keep it as a biological level as we can. In other words, the more we understand these things, the more we're now labeling them with names that reflect their pathology. And you see that in modern conditions. Post-traumatic stress disorder is one of the names that's been popping out. We no longer call it battle fatigue. You know, we call it something that we think made it function. And mood disorders is a very, very old term from the 50s, and it takes in too much. So I caution people to just describe what they think the animal is doing or what they think the animal has. So if they think that the animal has a fear of humans or a fear of other dogs, or they've got generalized anxiety disorder and they're reactive to all the things in the environment, let's first make sure that the animal meets the definitional criteria for that. In other words, we don't want to be medicating a normal behavior, and we don't want to be medicating an animal with the wrong drug for another condition. So we really need to do a good job of making a diagnosis. That said, and you need to understand that at this point in my life, I spend 150% of my time doing research and the other 50% working with patients. So I don't see as many patients as I used to. But that said, my clients, without exception, now, they're highly motivated. I'm hard to get an appointment with. It's expensive. My time is very limited. Without exception, they're willing to use medication if it's in the best interest or the welfare of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I just got a history form FedExed to me this morning, and the first thing the client said is, we know this dog is unhappy. All we want to do is whatever is best for this dog so that the dog doesn't have to be miserable.
Right.
And I think that's the key. And, you know, sometimes that's going to be environmental. So, you know, if you've got a neighbor's dog who's always harassing your dog, you can somehow manage to make sure that that situation stops or that your dog doesn't experience it. But if your dog is distressed, if they're chronically and fanatically distressed and worried about being left alone, and you know this because you videotape the dog and you've looked at what they're doing, and clearly when they're not with humans, they're upset and nothing has happened to them. You know, no one abused them.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happened. This is endogenous in the dog. At that point, one of the humane things to do is to use medication, because then you can break through the anxiety. You can begin to treat the anxiety. And then, of course, you add behavior modification once the animal gets rational enough to realize that they can learn to change their behaviors. And dogs can do this. Dogs learn that they feel better as soon as they stop reacting and they don't have to do so many of these things. And you can watch them acquire the behavior mod skills faster and faster once they learn that they feel better and that they have some control over that.
Interesting.
And that's a cognitive process.
Mm-hmm. What about aggression, Dr. Overall? That probably worries dog owners more than anything, because it's a cause for euthanasia for dogs, and you just can't have an aggressive dog.
Well, believe it or not, everything we've talked about is a cause for euthanasia of dogs, as are weird things like pulls too hard on a leash.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and I don't think most people realize it, but we still have 8 million animals euthanized every year in animal shelters in the United States. About 85% of those, it's been estimated, are due to behavior problems, and that's down from 20 million 12 years ago.
Hmm.
But it could be anything from, I bit the mailman, your neighbor, you, to I pulled too hard on a leash, and that was uncomfortable.
Hmm.
So what we need to realize is that behavior problems are, whether they're misunderstood normal behaviors, mismanaged behaviors, or truly pathological behaviors, they're an epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they will get animals killed. Aggression's a special one, not just because they get euthanized for it disproportionately, but because people are afraid of it, and they're afraid of it because of legal issues.
Right.
Everybody's terrified of being sued. And, you know, fighting a non-meritorious lawsuit is no fun. Fighting a meritorious one, I bet, is even less fun. So, you know, when we look at aggression, the vast majority of canine diagnoses and feline diagnoses that involve aggression are actually truly anxiety disorders in animals. Some of the more common aggressions in dogs, where they seem impulsive and explosive and unpredictable, they're actually quite predictable. The problem is the dog has an anxiety disorder where they don't know how they should react. So what they do is they provoke the environment to get information. And, you know, it depends on how then the human responds. And you can fix many of these very simply by explaining this to the people. And if the people stop responding in an antagonistic or an aggressive manner themselves by whacking the dog,
right,
the dog suddenly realizes, oh, wait, there is no threat. But if a dog can't get information from context, if that's their pathology, that they're always worried and they're expecting something bad to happen and they can't get the information, and when they provoke the environment, you smack them, you just told them that, yes, look, in fact, I am a risk for you. You aren't safe. There is something to worry about.
Yeah, interesting. One of the doctors in the piece said that people's willingness to employ behavior-modifying medication stems in part from a growing desire for more convenient, obedient household animals, and some of the medications do work for that. Do you think we've gone overboard, that we want our dogs and cats to be these perfect animals?
Yeah, I think we've gone overboard, and we want our kids and our dogs and our spouse to all be from Lake Wobegon and be perfect. We want all of those things. But that has less to do with the medication issue than just how we choose our animals and this sort of way we conduct our lives. The truth is that because these medications affect how you make molecular memory, in other words, how you learn things at the molecular level in parts of your brain that are associated with that executive function, making decisions, and with associational learning. And the easiest associational learning for anybody to think about for a dog or cat is simply sit, good girl. You know, that's an association. The dog learns if they sit, they're told that they're good. But these medications affect those parts of the brain, and they allow you to learn better and faster. So what you really have here is a facilitation of behavior modification. It's very much like the diabetic situation. You can better regulate diet and blood sugar levels in eating if you can regulate the glucose level first, because a low or a high glucose level affects other things, which then affects your behavior. It's exactly the same situation here. If you've got neurochemicals that are out of whack and you can't learn as well as you could have, what do you think that's going to do for any behaviors that you would like to have reinforced? You know, it's that type of complex issue. And it's interesting because my clients range from literally people who never finished high school to rocket scientists. And they all somehow manage to understand that. They manage to understand that when you have a true pathology, whether it's been induced by abuse or exposure to horrific situations, or whether it's endogenous and likely genetic but not necessarily genetic, it could just be a mistake in that individual's functioning that you were born with, doesn't matter whether which you have, that part of the humane way of treating this is allowing you to rediscover ways to handle the stimuli that upset you. And they all understand that medication speeds the process by which you acquire those
stimuli. Mm-hmm. How do you determine if it might be genetic?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because that's what I've been spending the last 8 years of my life doing. And there are two main ways that we've been doing this, and we're finally beginning to think that we might have identified some potential genes that might, or genetic regions that might be at risk. Notice how carefully I couched all of that, because you know, in the beginning, sample sizes matter, and we've only mapped a few hundred dogs for these behavioral traits. But there are two ways you can do it, and we do it both ways. The first is the one that I think everybody started to do years ago, and I've been doing since I was in this field for 20 years ago, is when possible you collect a pedigree. So in other words, I look at a purebred animal and I see a genetic experiment that's already been done for me. You know, I look at these purebred animals and these breed groups as gold mines of information, because what you have is sort of a canalized genetic variation. If you've got a breed of herding dogs versus a breed of terriers, you've asked for those dogs to do different behaviors, because that's how we selected dogs, on the basis of how they worked with us. So if you've got that, you've already got the genetic experiment. Now if you look at the different family lines of those things, you've got genetic experiments that are even more confined. So, you know, if you've got one father three generations back that seemed to give rise to all of these offspring, and half of those offspring are affected with a problem like noise phobia, then you have probably a genetic pattern. So we look at these pedigrees and we ask the people, were any of the family members also affected? And if they say yes, you know, we ask them to identify in the pedigree who's affected and how they're affected. And then we try to get blood samples from as many of those animals as possible. The second part sort of capitalizes on the first way of doing this, using pedigrees, but it doesn't necessarily require a pedigree, and that's called a case control study. And in that case, what you do is you get the genetic samples from all of as many dogs as you can who have this condition, preferably within a breed. And now it's not because you think it might be more common in the breed, although it might be. It's because you're minimizing genetic variation that might be due to different breeds. So let's say you have a bunch of border collies, and some of them react to noise, and some of them don't. If you now compare the genetic sequence of those dogs, and you find what we call polymorphisms, or variations in the alleles, or the parts of the chromosome that are inherited from either parent, now what you see is, oh, look, the dogs that have this variation are 14 times more likely to have noise reactions or noise phobias than the dogs that lack it. And now you've begun to establish a genetic basis for some of those conditions.
Let's welcome phone calls, and our lines are almost full at this moment. Our guest is Dr. Karen Overall, Research Associate in the Department of Psychiatry and Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Clinical Behavioral Medicine for the Small Animal and Manual of Veterinary Behavioral Medicine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Overall also has Wisconsin ties. She holds a PhD from the University of Wisconsin. Amazing how many people have Wisconsin ties. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dr. Karen Overall, starting with Jan from North Freedom. Hi, Jan.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Yes, just one simple fact. You know, I've had many pets. I've had many animals, relationships with many animals over my lifetime. I'm 65. I'm talking about horses, I'm talking about hens, I'm talking about parakeets and canaries, cats and dogs, toads, you name it. And the one fact that I think we talk about how smarter animals are, but the simple fact I just want to express is that I feel that animals are emotional beings. And you asked a question earlier on in the program about why we need to medicate our pets and why our animals respond in our family and our home life as people or emotionally or with problems and various, not only problems, but just how animals react to us and to stimuli and have problems or help us with our problems. I would just have to say that we don't often hear about how animals are emotional beings. We often hear about how smart they are, and we brag about our dog and how they can do these tricks and how our cats are aloof, but they are so much like people. I mean, really, animals are like people. And which is why we need them in our lives and so on. But I think we need to reflect on not only what they do for us, but what we do for them or to them. And we need to look at them as emotional beings also. The intelligence part is one facet, and their emotional beingness is a facet. And there's more that goes beyond that, too. And that's just what I have to say.
It's interesting that you say that because I think you're going to start to hear a lot more of it. I don't think the intellectual or cognitive component is actually separable from what's being called the emotional one. Part of the problem has been that we're not good at measuring some of the quote-unquote emotional components. And getting people to agree, and this is a sad statement of affairs for humans also, but getting people to agree on when something's distressed is a lot easier than getting them to agree on when something's normal. And it's a function of the way we measure things. Animals of all species have been shown, and the more research that is now done on how they think and problem solve leads to how they view their world and how they process that information. And animals of all species have been shown to have the neurochemical correlates of, in many cases, not all species have been measured, but the neurochemical correlates of emotions that would be associated with distress or sadness or happiness. And the interesting thing is that not in the United States, but in the European Union, the behaviors that are associated with comfort and enjoyment are the behaviors that are used as indicators of animal welfare. And it doesn't matter if that's a chicken or a pig or a pet dog. And Switzerland has recently passed a law that insists that you give your dog a certain amount of exercise and training because they're recognizing that these are things that they want and that they need. But it's interesting that what your caller is calling the emotional component is basically at the foundation of how the Europeans are structuring their welfare concerns. And, of course, we don't do very much structuring of welfare concerns in the United States. In fact, and this is something that I don't think most people know, laboratory animals are governmentally regulated to have a certain amount of intellectual stimulation and emotional stimulation. People must pet cats in colonies that are run for research. And there's no such regulation for pets.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's not a trivial issue. But as I said, people, you know, for years people thought that anybody talked about how smart dogs were or how much they observed. These people were just wacko. And, you know, now finally we're getting the scientific information to say, you know what the problem is? The problem is that people have really been too anthropocentric. In other words, everything is focused on humans. And anthropomorphism means that you attribute human characteristics to animals. Well, no, we're not really doing that. What we're beginning to do is understand the animal characteristics that we've ignored because we're so anthropocentric. We think so much as humans in our views that we've missed the essential elephantness or ratness or weaselness or dogness or catness. And I think that's changing. For the better, thank the gods.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Paul from Madison. Hi, Paul.
Yes, I've got 2 points about the your question earlier near the top of the program about can animals talk and think and communicate. There is a book in the Historical Society here in Madison, I think by Ellen Russell Emerson, that was published in 1880 and has never been out of print since, and supposedly. And if this is the correct source, she mentions at least one case in which the Indians claim, I'm talking about Native Americans now,
right.
Native American Indians claim that some of their medicine men can have communication with the Great Spirit, and they have visions of the Great Spirit inquiring of a game animal, like a deer, because the Indians are hungry, would you, deer, be willing to go to such and such a place and be willing to lay down your life for my Indian children to the greater honor and glory of me, the Great Spirit? And the Indian medicine man supposedly sees the animal agreeing. Then he comes out of his vision and tells the Indian hunters, go to such and such a place on such and such a day and time, and you'll find such and such an animal there. And by report, the animal shows up on schedule.
Right, and there's a rich body of Native American creation myths and what are still stories, which are sets of rules about how to live ethical lives, really, where you ask forgiveness and you ask permission to take another animal's life for the whole scheme of things that is somehow interrelated. And, you know, clearly that's a tacit acknowledgement of those cognitive and those abilities that have to do with emotion. And they're there. In fact, Donald Griffith tried to write, and I think he did a fantastic job, but he just didn't have a lot of the science available to him that's available now, to write about animal thinking. And in the 1960s and 70s, and I think there was a final book in the 80s, he wrote a series of books on how animals think and mentioned some of these creation myths. Mark Beckhoff, of course, has talked extensively extensively about local folklore and how animals communicate. And, you know, anybody who was reading the AP reports out of the horrible tsunami in Thailand noted that the elephants alerted many people to what was going on. And they clearly were able to recognize those cross-species signals. And I had a dog that, who unfortunately died of cancer this past year, but who was an amazing animal. And I never had to get up. I not only knew what species was out in the yard from his vocalization, but if it was a dog or a human, I knew who it was because he identified it by bark. And I then found out that that's been reported before. It's actually out there in the literature that these types of identifications and communications take place, and very few people have paid attention to.
Thank you, Paul, very much for the call. Let's hear from this voice that, again, was in the Times article. It's Dr. Ian Dunbar, a veterinarian who has his doctorate in animal behavior, and he does this instructional empire, they call it. He says, I've never in my life had to resort to using drugs to resolve a behavior problem. The rush to the medicine bottle for easily resolved problems like canine obesity, just feed the dog less, shows a disturbing parallel to the human approach to health care. He says, we lead an unhealthy lifestyle and then rely on drugs to correct it.
Yeah, well, you know, this is an interesting issue because, of course, Ian takes these things from the training standpoint. As you said, his empire is a training empire, and he doesn't really practice veterinary behavioral medicine. He deals with dog training and a lot of trainers. And there are two points about that. One is that he's unlikely to see my patient population, and my patient population has already been through that training cycle. In other words, I'm seeing the worst of the worst.
Mm.
So a lot of how you make decisions depends on your patient population, whether you have a severe one or not. And research patient populations, as anybody who knows who's tried to get state-of-the-art cancer care, always are more extreme populations. But the issue about whether or not we're treating these sort of social conditions with a pill is not a trivial one. Certainly you could feed the dog less and exercise them more, and that might be the best long-term strategy. But if you look very carefully at how people actually who've studied these medications involved in obesity recommend using them, is the same way they would recommend using them in a human. You use them in a short-term emergency situation where it's a matter of not just life and death, but of quality of life, and you hope to use it to transition to a better, more healthy lifestyle. The fact that that may not happen may not affect the decision the clinician's making. In other words, I'm always looking at the welfare of my animals, and I'm not going to medicate a patient who actually really needs to go out five times a day. You know, I say to the clients, put on a lead, take the dog out, here's how we're going to do this. This is a management-related issue. You certainly don't need medication for this, and in fact, I can't believe that it would help. And medication doesn't help normative problems. And that's something that I don't think people realize, that, you know, if you've got a bratty animal or you've got an animal who's not house-trained or you've got a relatively normal animal for that breed, you're going to see a big change in medication because it's targeted towards problematic and neurochemical changes, and you don't have those.
Right. Let's go to Paul from Hixton. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Really enjoying the show this morning, and my ears perked up when I heard that you had several Australian shepherds.
Four.
You have your hands full.
No kidding, and three of them are under the age of 3.5.
Wow.
Yeah.
We bought one a little over a year ago, and he was a very cute little puppy, and then, wow, did he get challenging for his first year.
Yes.
And I guess he would. Some of the things he would do is if he just heard anybody walking down our country road, he would just attack.
Yeah.
And very, very territorial and guarding the family. I really thought that we were not going to be able to keep him. I was afraid of being sued, and I was afraid of him getting run over. And we eventually, after thinking about it a lot, got a one of those buried fence shock collar systems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of wondering, for him, it seemed to have worked very well. He's calmed down a lot and seems to realize he doesn't have to guard us from the world. And I'm just kind of wondering about your feelings about that.
That's a great question for so many ways, because it allows me to address the basic issues that are involved in all behavior problems. First of all, the issue with breeds. You know, as you know, Australian Shepherds, or I don't know what color yours is, but...
he's a red one.
Yeah, they're stunning. You know,
it
doesn't matter
dog.
If they're a solid color or they're a merle. You know, my youngest puppy, who was turned into rescue at 7 weeks, because after a week they were already sick of him and he'd been sold before the legal age in Philadelphia.
Oh,
so that
my.
Tells you something.
Mm.
He's got two blue eyes and he's a red merle, and every time somebody looks at him, they fall in love with him. They don't think about what these dogs do for a living. And these are dogs that were developed to herd cattle by grabbing their heel. Okay, so when you think about that, what you've done is they round up and they guard things. That's what they were asked to do, and that's what the dog did for you. They're also tremendously active. They are what nutrition people call easy keepers. You don't have to feed them a lot, and they don't lose a lot of weight because they've got a metabolism, generally, if they're off stock lines, where they, you know, they've had to work long hours, and they can accommodate that. And they love to eat, but, you know, they'll work very long hours, and that's what your dog was doing for you. And often people will say he's great with the family, but he's not good if strangers come to the family. Part of that may be normal behaviors that need to be shaped, and part of that may be anxiety. And you can't tell unless you have a complete behavioral history. But the thing that you did is that you gave this animal the one piece of information that he needed, and that's where the perimeter was. Where do you have to guard? Now, had that animal been pathological and felt that he needed to guard anything, fences tend to make those animals worse because now they have a defined boundary, and they're damn sure going to protect that. In your case, you told him where he didn't have to worry. Now, I will caution you. I don't think that anyone should use shock in fences or in collars, because believe it or not, in fence situations, if it works for the dog, you could have done it with another kind of fence. If the dog is pathological at all, or the least bit reactive, and you shock the dog, they get worse. So now, again, it goes back to the reassuring that they're a threat, and that's what they're trying to find out. But what you did is you provided the animal with information about where the space actually was and what he didn't have to do, and that's a tremendous relief for animals. You know, all of my guys are quiet now because when I tapped the one on the head who was barking, I just said, you know, I mouthed to him, thank you. He knew that was good. It's over. It's done. You don't have to tell me anybody's here right now. I'm doing something else. And just acknowledging them, giving them information. They're social animals. Makes a difference.
Yeah, he's like a different dog.
Absolutely.
So,
information
so
is priceless. But the other thing that you had happen is that he went through social maturity. And when you said challenging, that's the word. Because dogs undergo a neurochemical change in their brains that humans do. Human females start it in their mid to late teens, and they're pretty much through it by their mid-20s. Human males start it in their late teens, and by the time the one study by Daniel Weisberger that used imaging at NIMH was finished, some of the 30-year-old males still weren't through this period. And during social maturity, your neurochemistry sort of undergoes this upheaval, and then you settle down into what will be your lifetime sort of range of patterns. If you are going to have a psychiatric illness, or if the animal is going to have a psychiatric or behavioral illness, and I prefer the word behavioral for dogs just to make sure we're not pretending they're people, is, you know, that's going to show up at social maturity. So somewhere between 10 or 18 months of age, they begin to go through this period, and they can be out of it by 18 to 36 months of age. And my service dog, Australian Shepherd, who was born into rescue, was raised by somebody for the first 8.5 weeks of his life who was a trainer, came to me knowing everything, did service tasks. At 10 months of age, he went to the back pasture, and I swore he came back without his brain. You know, and it's that type of challenge, because now, instead of being compliant, he was finding out everything. He was asking questions about everything. And he wasn't making the same decisions because his brain chemistry wasn't the same.
May I ask a quick follow-up question?
Yeah.
He's basically wonderful in most ways, but he's destroying our back door, trying to get in. When he wants to come in the house, he just claws up the door.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if you can suggest a way for us to help him with that behavior.
Yeah, and I don't know if you'll like my suggestion. There are a couple of things you can do. If the question becomes, is he clawing to get in because he's being left out too much for his sake? In other words, would it be as easy as just allowing him to come in when he wants to come in? Or are there reasons when he has to be outside that he's still doing this? Because if he's truly distressed, you may need to address that, because that could be a sign of separation anxiety. It might not be. My first response would be, is it possible to let him in when he wants to come in? And I often feel like a doorman for the dog, since I do most of my writing at home. And when I'm home, I am a doorman for the dog. But it also makes them incredibly responsive to me, because they ask for something. I take their question as something of value, and I answer it.
Mm-hmm.
If you, what you want to do is to get him to stop destroying the door, there are some very clever things that you can do. If he... you have trouble cutting his nails, or you don't want to cut his nails, you can make the part of the door that he's destroying into a sandpaper thing where he files his own nails. And that actually gives him something to do. You can teach him to ring a bell. My dogs are all taught to ring bells if it's an emergency. There are bells on the doors. If I don't see them and they whack the bell, somebody comes running. The other thing you can do is Premier Pet Products carries a product designed for dogs that have trouble at doors, and it's basically a computerized behavior mod reward program that involves a machine with treats. And males love it more than females. Everybody loves it. But my male clients just love this because it's a gizmo, you know, and it's got all this high-tech chip technology in it. And they're not that expensive. And what it does is it teaches the dog that if it sits down and relaxes by the door, it gets a treat.
Oh,
and
wow.
That may be the ticket for you. If, you know, he truly doesn't have a pathology. But again, you can also do something as simple as, and this isn't a gizmo thing, but as simple as when he first knocks, ask him to come in, sit down, and lie down, and relax, and reward him for relaxing. And then you can start repeating that. So in other words, you shift his reward pattern from you get rewarded ultimately because you're obnoxious and you wear me down, to you get rewarded because you're calm and relaxed.
Yeah, it's interesting. When he wants to go outside, he just kind of stares at the door and then stares at us. But
yeah.
When he wants to come in, you can really hear him clawing at the door.
Yeah, because one, he's already with you, so he has more control over you. If he can make eye contact, he can communicate with you. And it's interesting because that looking gesture, that it's a variant of the pointing gesture, is one of the hallmark things that indicates how cognitive dogs are and that they signal in the same way humans do.
Thanks, Paul, very much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. Dr. Karen Overall is our guest this hour, research associate in the Department of Psychiatry and the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Clinical Behavioral Medicine for the Small Animal and Manual of Veterinary Behavioral Medicine. She ran the behavior clinic at Penn Vet for more than a dozen years, and she frequently consults with service and assistance dog organizations and military and police organizations that use dogs in any capacity. She has given hundreds of national and international presentations and short courses, and she completed her residency in behavioral medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that in the remaining 10 minutes or so, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, following the news, the gathering storm, what happens when global warming turns millions of destitute Muslims into environmental refugees. Our guest is George Black, and the magazine On Earth has a cover story on As the Sea Rises, Millions of People in Bangladesh Will Become Environmental Refugees. And George will be with us the second hour of our program today. Two more phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I got a couple of questions. One, does the pet reflect the behavior of the family? So if you got a dysfunctional family, do you tend to have dysfunctional pets? Two, I got more. So, two, you know, you're anthropomorphizing, to use your own word, behavior all along here. And it's interesting to me because we medicate our children. we medicate our old people. Now we should medicate our pets. It may be that that's an interesting idea. The last thing I got to say is that if you do an experiment, you have to have a control group. So are your people in the business of confining animals, driving them nuts, and then having a control group to test the medication? How do you do that?
All good questions. There is a big and widespread belief that people who have dysfunctional families have pets that are dysfunctional. And there aren't very many well-collected data that are available on this subject, but the data that are available suggest that that's not the case. And instead, what you have is, if you've got a dog who's, or a cat, or, you know, something else that's living in the house, it could be a large parrot, who is more liable to be reactive in certain situations, and the household's unstable, the animal will be more reactive and will get worse. So it's not a direct effect. It's not that the household's nuts. And when you look at my patient population, we know that that's certainly not true. The interesting thing is, though, that when someone brings their animal for a consult for their behavior, if there is somebody in the family who has a psychiatric disorder or who is taking psychotropic medication themselves, they are very willing to talk about that, and they're very receptive. And they probably wouldn't bother to tell an orthopedic surgeon that if they set their legs. So,
right.
You know, it's partly a population view. The control group issue is a very important one because it would be inhumane in the extreme, and I don't think you could get this past any institutional animal use committee anymore, that you would drive animals nuts. Certainly that is some of what has unfortunately been done in the past. Instead, you can get your control groups from the natural world. So in other words, when you're studying the effects of medication, you study a set of animals that don't meet the criteria for the diagnosis, and you study a set of animals that do meet the criteria for the diagnosis, and you compare those groups, and you can compare the effects of medication or behavior mod or diet. So that actually is done, and it's done in a very humane way. It's not done often enough because it's very expensive to do, and few people are willing to fund real science. You know, I've been extraordinarily lucky, but part of that is that I'm in a medical school, and this is pretty much all I think about. So that gives you the advantage of getting more funding to do better science. As for the anthropomorphic viewpoint, you know, we're not making dogs into humans. I think that what anthropomorphism gives you is some empathy. And then what you really need to do, in my worldview, is step back and recognize the essential dogness or the essential catness of that cat. And you always make your decision based on what's in the best interests of that animal, what's in the best physical, physiological, behavioral, and welfare interests of that animal. And you have to remember that they are dogs and cats. So, you know, if the people want the dog to stop rolling in animal feces and jumping in mud, bad news. No medication on the planet is going to fix that because that's a normal dog behavior. And they need to live with it, or they need to ensure the animal doesn't have access to that stuff.
How do people, dog and pet owners, find their way to you?
How do they find their way to me? It's purely word of mouth.
Oh, really?
And the internet, because I do a lot of writing, and you know, I've written hundreds of book chapters, and so there are thousands, literally, worldwide, tens of thousands of veterinarians who've either heard me speak or read some of my things. So I get, you know, thanks to the internet, you now have access to everyone. So somebody who's read something or known something, or there are trainers in this area who work with the behavior mod with my patients, and they, you know, they say, they when they look at dogs that come to them, and they say, not a training problem. You need to go see Karen, and then I'll work with you. Those types of things. Also, we have, for our big collaborative research project on behavioral genetics, we have a website that's www.canine, just the letter K and the number 9, caninebehavioralgenetics, all one word, .com, and it talks about our genetic work. So we get a lot of people that way. So it's amazing the number of avenues that people now can use to get help. And, of course, the Specialty College has a website, too, that lists all the specialists. But I thought that I would have more trouble getting people to talk to me once we engaged in the big behavioral genetics project. And instead, it's been very easy because people are thrilled to find out if there are neurochemical or physiological or genetic or some combination of the above reasons for these things. And even though they know that the genetic things that we learn will probably not help that dog, the fact that it will help other dogs in the future matters deeply to these people.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. It was just a fascinating hour.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen. I really enjoyed it, and I thought your audience was great.
They are. They're terrific. Thanks, and it's nice for them to hear that. Dr. Karen Overall, Research Associate in the Department of Psychiatry and Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a number of books and articles, including Clinical Behavior Medicine for the Small Animal and Manual of Veterinary Behavioral Medicine. She has received a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and completed her residency in behavioral medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We thank her for her expertise and guide you to the New York Times Sunday Magazine, which has an interesting story, I believe. She said she disagreed with a lot of it, but it's an interesting story on Animal Farm, PHARM. Thanks, Rhonda Fanning, for producing the hour. John Anderson for on-air production here in Milwaukee.